From the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, KUAR Public Radio brings you Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, the only program on radio today dedicated to the preservation of comparative generational thought, with your host, Phil Marriage. Welcome to the Crossroads of History.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this very special edition of Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. I'm Phil Marriage, and our topic today is music education. Music flows in our lives really as importantly as any single expression we humans can share. And our stewardship of this art to our children's education has really been under question for quite some time. And my special guest today has established the Spirit of Harmony Foundation, which will be holding their symposium on the moral imperative of music education. And that'll be in partnership with the Clinton School of Public Service. And that's coming up here in April the 17th, 18th, and 19th. And introducing Todd Rundgren to you really would take the entire program. He is without question one of the most creative artists, producers, and gifted musicians of our time. And for you fans like me, you'll recognize it when I say he is a wizard, a true star. Todd Rundgren from his home in Hawaii, welcome to Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow.
Thank you so much. It's a lovely introduction. Flattered.
Well, before we get into the discussion really about music education, tell us a little bit about the Spirit of Harmony Foundation and the symposium that's coming up.
The foundation was actually sort of a roots-up movement, I guess, by my fans. We had a little retreat a couple of years ago in the New Orleans area, and we thought, let's do something maybe for the city of New Orleans. There was still a lot of work to be done, and the fans on their own collected $10,000, and we donated it to a music program there that was sort of struggling. And everyone got such a good feeling about that that they encouraged us, me, Ed, and the other board of directors of the foundation to do something more permanent. So that was the genesis of the Spirit of Harmony Foundation. And once we, you know, decided that, you know, that would be our mission, we had to get down to the business of figuring out how we fit into the larger picture. What is the value we bring to the enterprise? We're going to be discussing that at some length when we have the symposium, how we can best address what we believe is an important issue, as you've mentioned, the underfunding and the marginalization of music programs in school. When I was growing up, that was probably the only motivation I had for going to school, was to be in the chorus class or something like that. And now it's hard to even get sports programs funded. So we're trying to build our case, essentially, and provide ammunition to programs that, you know, are underfunded or are looking for more local support, and to give them the ammunition they need to convince their financiers that music is an important thing.
Am I right in what I understand to be the symposium here in Little Rock in April will be one of the first opportunities been able to gather some really strong voices to discuss this in an open forum like that and really maybe get the ball rolling more?
As I say, we're relatively new to this particular game. I've never established, you know, a nonprofit before, and things happen kind of fast for us. We got our nonprofit status in what I guess was record time, so we have not had the same amount of time to clarify our mission, to make all of the connections that we'd like to make. We see ourselves as a synergistic organization rather than a money machine, as it were. We want to be able to connect programs that have particular needs with the resources to satisfy those needs. And one of those resources, as I say, is information and ammunition to go out and find the underwriting for their programs. And the other is, as I say, actual hands-on helping to create these synergies, helping to connect, let's say, a program that might need musical instruments with a manufacturer that might like to donate them, that sort of thing. So I think the symposium is an opportunity for us to make a lot of connections, help to clarify our overall mission, and, as I say, to provide that first round of ammunition to go out and start getting support locally for the programs that they have.
And you will be here on Saturday, the 18th, and then I believe a concert you're going to be doing on the 19th, too.
Indeed. So it'll be a concert to raise, I guess, even more public awareness for the program, and also just for me to play the show that I'll be carrying around the country at the time.
Let me get back then again to actually music education. As a fan of yours, and I've talked with several fans over the time leading up to this, and many of them have said the same thing to me. We know a lot about Todd Rundgren and his songs and his career, but we really don't know a whole lot about your music education. Now, you alluded to just a few minutes ago about it, but really, how did you get your music education? And fill us in the blank on that part.
Well, when I was growing up, it was sort of assumed that a well-rounded education included art programs and music programs, and as well as sports programs and things like that. Even when I was in elementary school, there was a program where you could rent an instrument, and a tutor would come around like once a week and give you lessons on the instrument. And the first instrument that I thought I wanted to play was the flute, but I didn't realize how difficult it was both in terms of developing the embouchure to play it properly, but the fingering is kind of non-linear. I moved on after that to my sister's clarinet. She was taking a music program, but she wasn't as musically motivated as I was, so I learned how to play her clarinet, and my dad liked Pete Fountain and Mr. Ackerbilt. He was pleased with that. And this was in elementary school. Even the elementary school, it made sure that they got music into the school somehow. And music was always a part of very rudimentary education. I know that we would have a music class where they would teach us how to sing maybe a Mexican classic or some Lito Lindo. So you're getting culture as well as music.
I think mine was the Stephen Foster songs.
Yeah, songs of Stephen Foster, yeah. So you get a little bit of the sense of the old South kind of thing. Music is not simply for entertainment purposes. It's a cultural manifestation. And so an education in music also gives you insight into other cultures and the way that other people hear music. When I was in junior high school, as I mentioned, I got into the chorus program and learned a lot of what I know about singing and about harmonies and things and counterpoint and that sort of thing. I learned a lot of that in the course of learning Handel's Messiah or something like that for a big presentation that would happen every year or twice a year by the chorus class. So that was something that the school was very proud of at the time, that they had chorus that could put on events that were as important to school life as were football games and things like that. And even when I got to high school, there would be a band. There would be some sort of marching band.
Were you in marching band?
No, I was not in the marching band. That's when I started to yearn to play guitar, be in a band like the Beatles or something like that. So being in the marching band seemed very square. When I was growing up, music was still considered to be an important part of music education. And since then, and especially since, you know, schools have been shorted on funding as time goes on.
Was there even any word about funding for music programs then? Was it so innate into the programming that they didn't even worry about funding?
Well, it's one of those things that you can't test for, you know, like you can for math or history retention or those sort of things. You can give people a test for that. It's much more difficult to measure the effect that music has had on your overall education. And one of the things that we've discovered is that if you get some sort of formal training in music for 2 years, let's say, and you never even go on to become a musician or learn how to play an instrument after that, that the experience of music education changes the way that you process sound overall and gives you skills that are useful in other areas that are non-musical. For instance, if you've had 2 years of early musical education, for the rest of your life, you're better able than the average person to pick somebody's voice out in a crowded room and to be able to tune in on them and listen to what they're saying. Because musicians learn to pick apart the various elements that make up a musical performance and learn to listen for certain things. The average person, when they listen to music, they just kind of hear the whole thing. But you sell a musician, and what's the bass doing? And they can hum the bass part to you. Just a few years of music education changes the entire way that you process mm-hmm. sound for the rest of your life.
Did you do any private lessons of any type? I know you play almost everything, but did you ever get into lessons?
In order for me to acquire my first guitar, my parents had to buy 3 months worth of guitar lessons at the local music store.
Cool.
In other words, you got a discount on the instrument if you bought 3 months worth of music lessons. And I sort of endured the 3 months of the music lessons, but the music teacher was kind of an older guy. The kind of music that he was teaching me was of no interest to me. It was like old, some song called Fairy Bells or something like that, simple little ditties for beginners on guitar. And I had the ability to pick melodies out by ear. So by the time I got the guitar home, I was already learning songs off the radio and proceeding faster than the lessons were going. So by the time the 3 months was up, I didn't really go back to take lessons anymore. But as I say, we had a very serious chorus teacher and taught us a lot about the fundamentals.
You kind of alluded a little bit there about your parents. And as you look back at that time frame, the people in your peer group, were parents really supportive of music there as a group? It was something that almost every parent was trying to get their kids into music. And then compare that to what you see as time has gone on.
Back then, when I was growing up, music was an essential art form for my parents because they grew up in there was no television. They grew up in the age of radio, of film musicals, and big bands and that sort of thing. It was their principal form of entertainment, and television kind of edged it out a little bit. So music was important to my parents, and it was probably at least nostalgically important to everybody's parents in those days, even if they weren't connoisseurs of music.
Did you have to watch Mitch Miller?
I did not have to watch it. It did come on the TV on occasion.
Yeah.
I did watch it. But in those days, I much preferred the Nat King Cole show something like that to get a little musical influence. And my father was an appreciator of a kind of a wide range of music, all except for the new rock and roll, like that. He didn't want it in the house, but he did play a variety of music, contemporary classical music from Debussy and Ravel onward and Gilbert and Sullivan, and showed, you know, more contemporary kind of show tunes like musicals like Kismet and that sort of thing. So I got exposed to a pretty wide range of sophisticated music, unlike maybe a lot of my peers whose parents only listen to big band music or something like that.
Well, speaking of Gilbert and Sullivan, those of us who've watched a lot of your programs and seen you, it sure does seem like Gilbert and Sullivan had a pretty good influence on you.
Well, I certainly like the satirical aspects of it as well. I'm a big fan as a result of musical theater when it's done well, especially the lyrical aspect of Gilbert and Sullivan were a way for me to show off to my teachers and peers that I wasn't stupid in high school. Because I didn't do well, really, in high school, but I learned the entire libretto of Gilbert and Sullivan. I had a friend, and we would essentially challenge each other to learn these songs, and then we would perform them for each other. So I had memorized quite a bit of, you know, Gilbert. I remember sitting in the bathtub just memorizing lyrics from Gilbert and Sullivan. Instead of doing homework. So, that was a big influence on me. And it, as I say, like a lot of music, was a window into another culture, the kind of Victorian English culture that I was very fascinated with. So you would say, well, what is that a reference to? Something in the lyric. You would go kind of look it up in the encyclopedia and find out what it was a reference to and thereby learn something without actually learning it in history class. Music has a history that parallels everything that happens in history books. For every era in history, there's music that goes along with it. And we're the inheritors of all that. And people sometimes like to forget their history of human events. They also like to forget where music came from. Respects. It's easy to forget that rock and roll music is a result of American slave culture.
Right.
And that sort of thing. You know, field hollers and the repetition and rhythm that went with that. It became essentially the blues, and then the blues became rhythm and blues, and then that became rock and roll. So again, it's inevitable that if you go back to the roots of the music you like, you're going to learn something about the times and the history.
Well, when did you begin to realize that your music education and your interest in music could really open up some doors?
Well, I wasn't good at anything else when I got out of high school. I had an interest in computers and could have possibly gone to college to learn how to program computers or something like that. But we didn't really have the money. It didn't seem worth it because my study habits were so poor. And within months of leaving home, essentially, after I graduated from high school, I was in a band making enough money to feed myself. I just managed to parlay that one opportunity after another into an actual career in music. And some of it, I guess, you could call luck in that opportunities appear to you. But you also have to be prepared to take advantage of those opportunities. And I just always took any opportunity that came up, even if it didn't seem like what I wanted to be doing for the rest of my life. I just figured every one of those opportunities is a rung in the ladder. You don't go immediately to the top of the ladder. It would have been great to have been discovered like the Beatles.
Yeah.
A meteoric rise, but for most people it's going to be more work than that.
Those, again, who are big fans know that you play just about everything. And the question that came to my mind is, how often did you practice? I mean, did you practice hours and hours and hours a day on all this stuff? Or how did you educate yourself on all the different instruments?
Well, I used to be a slavish practitioner of the guitar. And I learned how to play piano principally to facilitate my songwriting. I was very influenced by Laura Nyro at one point, and she was a piano player.
Mm-hmm.
So I moved from writing my songs on the guitar to more writing songs on the piano. I never really desired to have the skill to be a piano player. And indeed, I can only play my own songs. I can't sit down on the piano and do much more than, you know, poke at it. But I did, you know, slavishly practice the guitar at one point. I don't so much anymore. And a lot of that is because I play every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I actually have been working a lot on the road between my gig with Ringo and my own gigs, and so I'm playing the guitar constantly and will probably be as good as I can get within, you know, a couple of weeks of being on the road. And that is really the best way to get good at an instrument, is to play in front of people, because your attitude is different. So you're just much more focused and often in some ways more liberated as well. So whenever anybody asks me how to succeed in the music business, and usually what they're looking for is to sell records and concert tickets, I say just take every opportunity you can to play in front of people. You'll get better just automatically by playing in front of people. You won't get better automatically just by woodshedding in your bedroom constantly.
One of the other basic questions I think many of us who listen to performers like you, that it seems so natural, that your education is so natural. And I wonder about the point at which you might have decided that education for you, like you said earlier, came from your ear. And can you speak a little bit about music education that comes naturally as compared to music education of the person who really does woodshed?
Not everyone who likes music is going to make that kind of commitment to becoming a professional musician. At a certain point, people discover their life's mission or whatever it is, and while they may have learned about music, you know, they go on to actually study and practice in some other field, which is natural. You know, as I say, not everyone has the aptitude, not everyone has the burning desire like I had to be a musician. Music doesn't affect everybody in exactly the same way. But it's important that we encourage those people who are going to really take it to heart and become serious about music and provide what essentially is a service to society by keeping music vital and reflective of the culture and that sort of thing. We haven't been doing that for a while. You know, we've just been letting those people go fallow and trying to convince them that music isn't worth the effort. Just get a good grade on your math test. It's a waste of a resource. not all music certainly is necessary or earth-shaking or soul-touching or anything like that. But if all it does is provide a respite in the average person's day from the things that are depressing them, then it's an important societal product. It's something that we need to have, or people will go crazy. They'll turn into like ISIS. They'll become the Taliban, just a joyless bunch of politically driven materialists. Music essentially softens things in a way. It takes the edge off of life. It never goes away. It's in your head all the time. And it's kind of a privilege to be able to continue to explore it. I've always felt, being so influenced by the Beatles, that being committed to music entailed a sort of evolution, in that the Beatles started out just playing other people's rock and roll songs, and as time went on, they began to learn so much about music that they created genres and discarded them, and then other bands would make careers out of those genres, you know, like so-called classical rock. The Beatles would write Helena Rigby and then move on to something else, and then the Moody Blues would get stuck in classical rockville for their entire careers. I always felt that the part of the appeal of music was that there were so many ways to hear it, and especially because we've got power to record it, a giant legacy of music for us to explore.
Well, you certainly have not pigeonholed yourself. I mean, you play all kinds of different things, and you have throughout your career. What you're coming out with now is entirely new stuff, as I understand. We're looking forward to hearing that. But kind of take me a little bit into the realm of technology. I know that's a big part of you. Where did technology begin to come into the music and the music education?
Well, my father was an engineer, so I was always comfortable with the technology. It was part of our household in a way. When I got older, because I had this comfort with the technology and because I had been very curious about it pretty much my whole life, I wasn't as put off by some of the newer developments as other people were. As a matter of fact, I had a keen interest in knowing what the possibilities were so that I could take advantage of them. When the first synthesizer was made commercially available to the kind of average public in a music store like Manny's in New York, I just scooped up the very first one and started noodling around with it, trying to figure out what was possible. As time went on, I became interested in computers. As I said, that's a career path I might have taken. But then personal computers came out, and it made it possible for me to learn on my own time how to program computers. And then there was the collision of computers and music. Eventually became the preferred tool for recording music and making music. And that's kind of where we're at now. Because I went to the trouble to learn about the technology, I could imagine where things might go and position myself so that, you know, a lot of other musicians probably didn't keep up with the changes and lost their competitive edge. And I just happened to be a little more up on it.
Well, and I guess in doing so, you have educated others who are probably learning from what you've done. I mean, they listen to you just like you used to listen to the radio, and I guess they're learning, too, to go forward with the technology.
It's kind of inherent in music that no man is an island. Everyone is influencing everybody else. We're working basically with a pretty small palette, the 12-tone Western scale that we're used to. But you discover that there are so many things that can be done with that limited palette that there is no real bottom to the well. That's why it's a great career.
Mm-hmm.
It can keep you engaged and interested pretty much for life.
It made me a performer, which brought me out of my shell in a way. When I was growing up, I was kind of a loner. I didn't get along. And being in a band makes you have to kind of socialize in a way. And it's not that I was very good at it, but at least it was a start, you know, trying to figure out how to be cooperative with other people and to make compromises and things like that. As time went on, I became a record producer, and so I had to learn how to take charge of a situation that involved people who were perhaps very apprehensive about the environment they were in and guidance and confidence and things like that. Becoming a record producer helped me to develop some actual people skills. So all the aspects of the music business kind of have made me what I am today, not just in terms of the kind of music that I make, but the kind of person that I am.
Where do you kind of see music education going in the next 10 to 15 or 20 years? Are we headed in the right direction?
Well, I think that, for one thing, the music industry is still pretty huge. And when I was just graduating from high school, to get into a band was still kind of considered a fantasy, you know, like a crapshoot. Nobody realized how big it would become, how large a return on investment you could get on a hit record or a concert tour or something like that. So music, aside from its aesthetic appeal and the other, as I say, aspects that may affect the rest of your life if you are given a little bit of education, it's big business as mm-hmm. well. So nowadays, someone can legitimately plan to have a career in music. There are schools for music that didn't exist when I was growing up that are trying to take up the slack. But those are, for a lot of musicians, maybe too expensive for them. We need to have that sort of foundational aspect in the schools available to everyone. The conventional wisdom is if you give kids music programs, changes their behavior because they have something to look forward to in the school or focuses them. These are all kind of immeasurable gains but that we all assume are there. But now it's possible to say, yeah, and if one of these kids, you know, actually does become a successful musician, he can become a productive member of society and possibly even an entrepreneur, somebody who can hire a bunch of other people like I have to do every time I go out on the road.
Right.
I have an opportunity to see a lot of these programs. There's a whole gamut of them, from very small kind of bootstrap programs to programs that have multi-million dollar budgets and several orchestras. They're all independent. None of them are sponsored by school districts or anything like that. They're essentially founded and funded and kept going, usually by small groups of very dedicated people. Those are the people who are going to bring music education back. We're just trying to raise awareness that these programs are everywhere and that they need to be adopted. Maybe the school doesn't want to create the classroom space for a whole band or something like that. But the school can become, you know, an active partner in that program and create the time for the students to go to band practice mm-hmm. and things like that instead of filling their entire day up with academics. What we really want to do is start identifying these people who are really the driving force, make personalities, make stars out of them, and then I think the schools will start to take notice.
We've been talking today here on Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow with Todd Rundgren. He'll be in town in April with the Spirit of Harmony Foundation. He'll be with the Clinton School of Public Service. They'll have their symposium on the 17th, 18th, and 19th here in Little Rock. I thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule there in Hawaii and joining us here.
Terrific. And thank you so much for focusing a light on this. And we'll see you when we get to Little Rock.
I'll be looking forward to seeing you when you get here.
Terrific.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Todd. I really enjoyed our discussion on music education today with Todd Rundgren. He really is one of the most creative artists, producers, and gifted musicians really of our time. It's been a real thrill to have him on the program. I hope you've enjoyed our discussion today with Todd Rundgren, who is really a wizard, a true star. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow is a production of KUAR Public Radio, Little Rock.